I'm Bob Boylan with a Plus One podcast from All Songs Considered. This is one of the most seminal underground records of the late 1960s. The band is called Pearls Before Swine, and the album is called One Nation Underground. That song, The Surrealist Waltz, is one of 10 songs on this almost forgotten classic. But thankfully, the album is being reissued 50 years after its initial release, and I'm so glad I can turn you on to a classic record you're likely not to know and hopefully will love as much as I do. It's an album that mixed folk music with exotic instrumentation, and joining me to talk about it is Pearls Before Swine singer and songwriter Tom Rapp. I start the conversation by playing the album's opening track called Another Time as Tom Rapp listens on the line from Florida.
Where have you been to? Where did you go? Did you follow the summer out when the winter pushed its face in the snow? Or have you come by again to die again? Well, try again another time. Did you follow the crystal?
To my 17-year-old or so self, when I first heard this song, I always kind of thought it was a song about the world and how little the universe seemed to care about anything, certainly not me or us or anybody else. And that's my interpretation. Could you tell me about this song and what this song, Another Time, meant to you?
It's funny. That was the very first song we ever recorded. Walked into Impact Sound in New York City and the first turned on the mics and started recording, and that was the first one. The song came out of a car wreck. That's kind of cool.
Wow.
And I was thrown out of an Austin Healey Sprite, and the windshield ended up in the top of a tree, I don't know, half a mile away, and I was just beneath the back tire, and it occurred to me that the universe didn't really care that much about me.
Okay.
And in fact, the police came. I wasn't actually injured. I had like a little scrape somewhere.
Wow.
And the police came, and I was listening to the police reports as they were taking us to the station. And people were dying all over the place in car accidents and fires and drownings. And I said, man, the universe does not care at all. I'm sorry.
So there's
we have a live report. Huh? Yes.
some people would say, well, God was looking out for me. I mean, that's another way you could have interpreted, but that's not the way. How old were you at the time this car accident happened?
22, I think.
Uh-huh.
And so I went home and I wrote the song. And then there it was, and I knew I had to go record it with a group called Pearls Before Swine. And we were all set.
Well, wait a minute now. First of all, that's...
I'm skipping ahead.
You're making huge leaps, which I love, but I'm going to back you up a little bit. Were you writing songs at all at that age, at 22?
I heard about Dylan. I learned how to play Blown in the Wind. I wrote little sort of protest songs, you know, about the Ku Klux Klan. But other than that, nothing really real. But this was the first one where I said, here's a song's actually about something here. At the time, I was listening to Tom Rush and Joni Mitchell and, you know, everyone you should listen to. The song started coming out, and then many of them were rather somber. Fortunately, I didn't have to have a car accident for each one. So that was good. That increased my lifespan a little, I think.
You were living in Florida at the time, but is that right? Or at 22?
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
But you recorded in New York. So help me with that leap right there. I mean, it's one thing to write a song in your bedroom or wherever you choose to write.
Yeah, right.
It's another thing to have friends to play music with, another thing to have to congeal and make something like creative. And then the last leap, which back then recording studios were not cheap. It's not like today where you go to a friend's house and record. So help me a little paint that picture.
Oh, well, okay. Three friends of mine from O'Galley High School in Florida had a tape recorder, a little old reel-to-reel at our house, and we were just playing folk stuff, and we got this great idea. I had heard of the group The Fugs with Ed Sanders.
Yeah, seminal New York band.
Now, I can't go into, like...
I'll just paraphrase. Yes, a seminal New York band, they try to shake things up with the words that they sung and wrote. Fair enough.
Yes, and rather successfully, I think, for a while, too. But he was also the editor of a magazine called Blank U, a Magazine of the Arts, which was a pretty funny darn magazine. So I read about them, and I read about they were with a studio called ESP, and most people would think, still do probably, ESP meant like extrasensory perception or avant-garde or something, but it was really a hobby of the guy who ran it, and he was into Esperanto, the artificial language. And he would record stuff in Esperanto, but he also recorded lots and lots of avant-garde jazz. He had Sun Ra and Albert Eiler and all kinds of people like that, you know, for a good while. We sent them we had a hand-cut vinyl that we had done in another town. We sent it to them and said, here, you want to record us? You record The Fugs, so you'll want to record us too. And we get back this letter, okay, come on up and record. And I swear to God, that's how you did it in those days. And we sent that up, and they brought us up to New York, and they introduced us to Richard Alderson, who is a brilliant producer. He worked with Dylan a lot. And they gave us 4 days in the studio, and we put the whole thing together in 4 days, which included the mixing.
Wow.
And the stopping and eating hamburgers at Smiler's Delicatessen down the street. And there we were with a 4-day record. And then it came out something like it was about the same day as Sgt. Pepper. And it was recorded on 4-track, just like Sgt. Pepper was, where all you have are 4 tracks and you have to mix everything down to 4 tracks that you can't do anything further with. And then you mix the 4 tracks all together and you have essentially a mono record, just like Sgt. Pepper was mono when they put it out. And ours was too. The first of our One Nation Underground record was mono, and which it'll be here too.
Let me go ahead and play a little something else. I'll play a bit of the song Uncle John, and we'll come back and talk about that.
Thank you. Okay.
When the wind winds the platform, blows through your suitcases. Well, you want us to crucify the enemy for Jesus. With your chamber of commerce soul, you talk the war so bold. God is on our side, but he's lost in your one and four. And the widows are sighing, children are crying, screams of the dying say you are lying. Pull out your Sunday God and hold him up so proud and say he is with us to the applauding crowd. But the burned blackened place, the shredded disfigured face, don't say that God is love. They say that you are hate.
I was wondering, when you went into a studio, really for the first time, did you sort of just play the songs and capture them, or did you create in the studio?
Yeah, well, you know, Richard had brought in Warren Smith, who's quite a good avant-garde jazz drummer, and the arrangements sort of came out of whatever he did with us. We would discuss these things. We wanted to put, say, an audio oscillator in one of the songs, so we got an audio oscillator and put it in. And we had lots of instruments from all over the world, which they were doing things with at that studio in another project. And so we would, you know, pick up instruments from all over and just see how it sounded when you put it in there.
And that
so,
there's
yeah,
an instrument.
I mean, they sort of composed themselves, yeah.
There's an instrument in there, that organ-y sound. I'm not sure if it is, but there's an instrument called a claveline that was used in Telstar in Runaway by Del Shannon. It's got that kind of piercing Farfisa organ sound. I'm
right.
Not sure if that's what that is.
I was
going
to say it sounds like Farfisa
yeah.
to me.
Okay.
But
that was something that didn't exist when you were working on these songs in Florida, but got added
right.
to the mix. That's what I'm trying to get the picture of, like how much was creation in those 4 days and how much was just a matter of like, we're going to document these songs because we've already got them well rehearsed. Sounds like a lot of creation.
I can't say they were overly rehearsed. We sort of just created from what was around us, and we tried to do a little of everything, like a folk song and a screamer song. And the four of us got together at high school and said, "Hey, gang, let's make a cult record." And so that's how we got going
you
on
sure
that.
You sure did it.
But yeah, there really was a little of everything. Somebody said it was sort of like the first cult record of that time, you know, just this, some of this and some of this and some of this. We had no idea what we couldn't do. Four kids from Florida, like the Beatles.
Right. There is a whole world of people who have not heard this record. And I'd love to paint a picture of the culture of the time. You've so far painted a very vivid picture of an innocence that you had, that just a go-do-it attitude, something that really 5 years previous to that I don't think existed much in American pop culture. It seemed very controlled by people with money, a very much
yeah.
straighter society.
Yeah.
So describe what it was like, what you were like, what you were into.
Yeah, well, at Impact Sound, it was one of those places where people would just come in and out, you know, and say hi. Ed Sanders would come in from the Fugs.
Yeah.
And Wavy Gravy.
Yeah.
At the time, his name was Hugh Romney. No relation to the other Romneys. And he would wear a bright orange jumpsuit, and he would evangelize acid. You know, he would say, "Try some of this, man. There'll be world peace. This is incredible." And it didn't really work out that way, but, you know, it would give some to everybody.
Were you all,
you know, people would
experimenting
just
as a band with that stuff, or were you a participant?
Well, it's a horrible secret, but mostly I smoked Winston's and sometimes Salem's. I really didn't even smoke what the kids called marijuana cigarettes.
Right.
I didn't even smoke that until, I think, the third album somewhere.
Uh-huh.
I was just sort of observing the man who fell to earth and looked at the drugs.
Right.
So a little of everything was there, and I was just fascinated by all that stuff, and I tried to report from the front on all this stuff. And, of course, the war was going on. I don't think people remember just so horrible having that thing going on all around us all day long, year after year. And an awful lot of people had a sense that maybe it's not the right thing to slaughter children. I mean, in the streets, especially in New York City, it was just Vietnam all the time. It was what you talked about, what you discussed. There was just like the saddest sin that was going on at that time and place. Yeah, and people were doing a lot of drug experimenting, but I think people don't realize that a lot of that drug stuff was really sort of experimental and explorative and not just, you know, light me three of those. And it really was explorative and, you know, what'll I find out if I do this. But I remember Phil Oakes said, you know, let's not just blow it like this.
Meaning let it not just be piece of recreation. Use it for creativity.
Yeah, I mean, let's get something constructive done and, you know, help out like we keep thinking we're going to do.
people talk of your band as these days as a psychedelic folk band, though I don't know that I ever remember that term in the day. Do you find that is fitting or weird? Or
Well, somebody said psychedelic Eastern. I didn't think of it as psychedelic, except in the sense of trying out all kinds of new, different things that people weren't doing, and seeing how it sounded when you mixed it in with the other stuff. You know, we weren't trying to be incomprehensible or anything like that. Mm-hmm. There were people who were psychedelic groups and so on. We did this and that. People would feel it was psychedelic, I guess. You could try Morning Song.
Okay, let's do a little Morning Song.
You know, it has a swine horn in it, which is kind of psychedelic by itself.
What is a swine horn?
Oh, okay. Well, we invented that, but it was using two different wooden recorders, the wooden instrument, the recorder,
right,
that they used from the time of Mozart on, probably, and we would play it at the same time in harmony, two of them at once.
Okay. Let's give a listen to Morning Song, and we'll listen for the swine horn.
There it is.
Yeah. Oh, that's it?
That's it, yeah.
I always thought that was just electronic something, but...
Well, it's actually, manual to regular acoustic instruments.
Along cool.
The cold and gross in an hour. The gray wall dwarf leaps high. Silent with a cry.
That line about laughing with a lisp, you're a singer who sings with a lisp. Was that ever a self-conscious thing? Was that hard for you to do, or did you feel free in those days?
No.
That's good.
After the record came out, I'd see in reviews and stuff, and there's this, and he's got this lisp. And I said, what are they talking about?
Wow.
And now I just heard it now, because I was looking for it. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't really aware of it. It was just one more extreme talent that we brought to the music industry,
You also brought, I'm going to just play a tiny bit of this, and you can explain to people what's going on in this song, speaking of talent to the music industry. You're challenging radio in many ways with this little number.
Oh, yes.
Tell people what's about to happen in this Miss Morse song.
Okay. The chorus is in Morse code. And I was actually looking for something with a certain beat. And I looked in the Boy Scout manual that one of us had in our house. And I was looking for love, L-O-V-E, and it didn't work. It wasn't the right assemblage of beats. And so I tried, being a musician, I tried F, and it worked perfectly. So it was dit-dit-da-dit, da dit da dit, da dit da. Okay, and so that was kind of cool.
So you had
but
the
we should
F
have warned people.
F and a U.
Yeah,
and a
we should
C
have warned people because you'd have people out there. The only people in the world who really knew Morse code in those days probably was the Boy Scouts, and they'd be sitting there, and all of a sudden, like, oh my God! And the Boy Scout masters and stuff would go, oh my God! And so it got banned in some places. But hey, it's in Morse code. What do you want?
Let me play a little.
Did did da did. Did did da. Did da di da di da di da.
I love that. I thought that was so playful. Politics. Let's go back to a song that reflected the powerful times. This is 1967. We watched daily as the body count from Vietnam came across TV screens. We were both of age, almost for me, soon to be a draft age. You were of draft age. So many of our friends were going off to fight a war that we didn't believe in and just saw our country taking a wrong turn. As a songwriter, what did that do for you?
It was a great source of anger. You know, it was like, what can we do about this? And everyone was trying to do something active out there in the streets. And as a songwriter, you thought, well, maybe you can reach somebody and they'll like, think about this and they'll start changing their mind. And it was a very hard time. It was just very sad. I knew two people who died. And my grandmother was telling me that every year they have a Memorial Day for all the guys from that area that had died in Vietnam. You know, so they talk about him, you know, 50 years later. He should have, you know, had kids and gone bowling. And so it was just a completely wrong and completely dishonest and hard to believe people like voted for it or went along with it.
And people started shaking things up and making noise in the streets and noise in the airwaves and so forth. What do you have a contribution on this record that you felt was toward all of that awareness?
Probably just all the screaming on Uncle John. At the end of that screaming, I like fell over on the floor. I used up all my breath screaming Uncle John, you know.
Who is Uncle John to you in this song?
Oh, yeah, right. Good idea.
I mean, is it Uncle Sam, you know?
But. Yeah, I thought Uncle Sam, and at the time it was President Johnson.
Ah, I never got that. Let's get the screaming. You never made a penny off this record.
Oh, good. Yes. No, we never did. In fact, we just, over the last couple years, we got our rights back from ESP.
Because you sold a bunch of records. You have an idea how many you sold?
About 250,000. And no, seriously.
Wow.
Because when we, later on, we were trying to do something to get something back, and people in the industry were checking it out. So about 250,000, we think. The owner was Bernard Stolman, who ran ESP Disc, and he is now passed away.
No pun intended there, isn't that Stoll?
No. And he told me the CIA and the mafia were putting all of them out themselves, and they didn't get any money from them, ESP. And so, of course, they couldn't give any of it to us.
That somebody was bootlegging their own records.
Bootlegging, yeah.
And I actually have one of those. The cover of it, you could just tell, was cheaply pasted on. So I'm not saying he's truthful or not truthful, but I know that the record version that I have always looked like a bootleg to me, and I never understood why.
It was probably sepia or black and white or something.
Absolutely sepia.
So that's where all the money went. So there was just no money until we finally got attorneys onto it later, after we realized it was almost 50 years.
Wow. And he's passed away just a few years ago, Mr. Stolman.
He's buried upstate. So now we control both of these, and we're going to put out Balaclava sometime next year.
Which was
and have a 50th anniversary of Balaclava, you know.
And these days, you're a lawyer, no? Yes?
Did the civil rights law. I was an attorney in Philadelphia for about 20 years.
Do you ever get the itch to make music anymore?
Yeah. In the 90s, people started showing up wanting to like do interviews and stuff. And I started playing at Terra Stock. I don't know if you know Terra Stock, but that's a magazine in England. And they would have every year, more or less every year, they'd have a Terra Stock festival. And I agreed that I would play at one of those and ended up playing it at a few. A guy came up to me and he had put together and was just about to release. It was called For the Dead in Space, and it had like 20 covers or something. I was just amazed that anyone even knew these songs. It was amazing to me how well-known we were in a large secret way.
Well, One Nation Underground sort of sums up, in many ways, who you were as a band. I mean, for those who knew you, madly loved you. And Underground back then was a precursor to what people eventually would call college rock or alternative rock, or you name it, indie rock. I mean, it was a music that was... not the mainstream, and it was nice to be a part of that growing up.
Right.
Thank you so much for doing this today, and congratulations on such amazing music.
Oh, thank you. Could I bring up something?
Of course you can.
No? It was just so ironic when we discovered it was 50 years ago. Right. So we're going to put this out again, so that's great. And we're starting to get it together to put it out, and I'm diagnosed with cancer. And I said, oh, well, that fits together. That's very nice. And I was diagnosed with, it's called extramammary Paget's disease, which was in the groin. You know, and they had an operation. They took it out, not the groin, but this stuff. And then a few months later, it came back like little hippity-hoppity happy little bunnies and started showing up in my pelvis and my sternum and all kinds of other just... interesting places. And I started getting radiation and chemo. So it's being treated. It's being treated by the medicine they use with Jimmy Carter, where he had a brain tumor just disappear, you know, out of his head when he thought he was like at death's door. And so they're working on it. You know, I'm hoping that Pearls Before Swine fans will help me get my last wish, which is that I'd like a pony. But so anyway, it was just ironic that, you know, we're getting this thing back in the news. And otherwise I was planning on working on the 100th, remastering there. But so I think that'll all work out fine, but it's just interesting to have it all happen at the same time, you know?
Well, it sounds like you have the right attitude, and I and along with all the other Pearls folks, wish you well.
Thank you. Yeah. Maybe a Shetland.
A Shetland pony. Actually. And where do we deliver this? How do we collect and where do we deliver? it's great talk to you. As a cancer survivor, I really empathize with you.
Excellent.
And it can be okay. So bless you, man.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good. I'm glad you're doing well.
I am. Thank you so much
for
this and all the great music. It's really meant a lot to me in my life and I know so many others.
Thank you, man.
So thank you. Cheers.
Thank you.
Be well.
Bye-bye.
Tom Rapp, the creator, singer and songwriter from Pearls Before Swine. The album, One Nation Underground, is out now on Drag City. I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.
Drop out with me. Just live your life behind your eyes. Your own sky. Your own tomorrow. Don't you worry now, don't you worry. Whole world's in too big a hurry. Just be yourself. No one can step inside your mind from behind. If you just walk out. Don't you worry, girl. Don't you worry. Whole world's in too big a hurry. They made the rules and they laid it on us. Oh, don't you fall. Cause then they'll own you. Don't you worry, girl. Don't you worry. Whole world's in too big a hurry.
loving. Don't you worry, girl, don't you worry. Whole world's in too big a hurry. They made the bomb. Would they drop it on us all, great and small? But must we follow? Don't you worry, girl, don't you worry. Whole world's in too big a hurry. Drop out with me. Just live your life behind your eyes, your own sky, your own tomorrow. Don't you worry, girl, don't you worry.